Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest today is Steve Gabriel, a permaculture instructor with the Finger Lakes Permaculture Institute and an extension office aide at Cornell University, who researches agroforestry and mushroom cultivation with Dr. Ken Mutch. Our conversation broadly covers agroforestry, what it is, the various techniques involved, and what we can learn from these practices as permaculturists. Mushroom cultivation and forest gardens are woven throughout. Two terms of particular interest that stood out to me are analog design and upcycling, which I leave to Steve to explain. His experience with academic research blended with permaculture and his articulate explanation of the material at hand, even when I throw some curveballs at him, make this a nice extension to several of the past interviews, including those with Ethan Hughes or Dr. Byrne Sweeney. After you listen to Steve, I recommend going back through the archives if you haven't made your way through them, and listen to those or other guests that catch your eye, or maybe I should say ear. As you listen to those, the pieces start to fall into place about how all the conversations, past, present, and yet to come, about both visible and invisible structures, are connected within the web of permaculture. While exploring this and the other material, if you find any of it useful and can take a few minutes to help keep the show going, you have my deepest thanks. Go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support to make a one-time or recurring monthly donation. You can also help spread the word by leaving a review on your favorite podcast site or iTunes, and by following the show on Facebook at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast or on Twitter at permaculturecst. Now then, on to Mr. Gabriel. I'll join you afterwards with some notes and updates. Then, as I usually like to start these interviews, if you could give us a bit of your background and biography, how you came to permaculture and the work that you're doing now.
Yeah, sure. I took an environmental science class in my senior year of high school, and that was really the beginning of my awareness of environmental issues. It was a pretty depressing class. We covered, you know, hydrology, we covered soil, we covered how the earth works, and we discussed and did experiments to learn how humans have really been destructive to those natural systems. And that was kind of the end. We didn't get a lot into solutions. And so it really set me on this trajectory to travel the world and spend some time during college to try to find some answers to how I could actually be part of the solution. And I did a semester abroad in Scotland at the Finhorn Eco Village, which was my first introduction to permaculture. And from the minute I started learning about it, it just clicked, and it was just the right discipline to bring all the things I was interested in and to provide some answers to that seeking I had to find solutions and to be part of that solutions, and for it not to be a policy level or really big picture thing, but things I could actually do in my own backyard. And so that really led me to further study permaculture, take a PDC. I did it in Earth Haven in 2002. And then I moved back to the Finger Lakes where I'd grown up in upstate New York, in the Ithaca area. And we started the Finger Lakes Permaculture Institute in 2005. And we've been running courses and doing apprenticeships and traditional permaculture education. And along that way, I connected with people at Cornell, in particular, a professor named Ken Mudge, who I'm writing this book with. And he and I formed a relationship where we worked and co-taught a class in an agroforestry site that exists on Cornell campus. It's sort of this relic of a slight resurgence in an interest in agroforestry that happened in the early 1900s, around 1920. And so this professor had planted this nut grove, and we started teaching in there, and one thing led to another. And that's where I started learning about mushroom cultivation. And it's been a nice marriage to take the permaculture understanding I had and bring it to a university setting and work on agroforestry. And I think the two practices are, in some ways, when you look at the systems, you know, very indistinguishable.
Now, are you studying agroforestry as an academic as well as practicing, or how do you divide that work up?
I spend some of my work, I work part-time for Cooperative Extension. So I'm on campus. I coordinate materials, resources, and trainings with county offices. Every county in New York State has an extension office. And so I do a lot with gardening, and I'm starting to do more with permaculture on campus because there is a lot of interest. So I do some teaching. We have a permaculture class now on campus, and we also do things in the extension offices. And that's one hat. And then the other part I do is specifically with Ken, we're doing mushroom research. So we're actually doing forest trials of different mushroom cultivation techniques, different variables, and we're coordinating that with farms around the Northeast to also learn more about how we can grow mushrooms successfully in the woods.
Cornell is the land-grant university for New York, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, because we have Penn State here in Pennsylvania. Would you feel comfortable giving like a 2-minute elevator pitch of what the Extension services are for listeners outside the United States?
Sure, yeah. You know, Extension is a pretty powerful tool, and it's one of these points in American history where government and institution came together and said, you know, we really need to serve the public and we really need to serve the greater good, and that research at institutions should be serving the greater good. And we should make sure that there's a clear connection between the universities and the public. And so I think the simplest way to think about it is sort of a deal. It's the government gives the land grant university, and in New York State, it's Cornell. And like you said, in Pennsylvania, Penn State, tax breaks and access to land, access to different resources. And the exchange is that the university then engages with the public and really focuses its efforts around serving the public. And so asking really the right questions, what do farmers need? What do homeowners need? And how can the university research really serve that need?
And my understanding of the Extension services is that they're also very science-based, that it's coming out of the research of the universities on what the best practices should be for agriculture or gardening or anyone else who wants to utilize the various services that each Extension office offers.
We try not to make recommendations that are hearsay or that are anecdotal. Try to base them in scientific study as much as possible. And I think this is where permaculture can benefit. I think the origins of permaculture were something that, you know, Bill Mollison was a university academic and then sort of was frustrated with the lack of acceptance and sort of brought permaculture out of academia into, you know, a grassroots type movement. And now, at least in the Northeast and in the United States, we're seeing a migration back to universities where the new wave is interdisciplinary and multifaceted and to look at the connections between things. And so permaculture is actually, there's more permaculture courses on campuses now, you know, every year, and it continues to grow. The interest seems to be sort of endless, which is a really good thing. And I think the academic community can bring scientific rigor and discipline to permaculture. And I think we really need to tell really good stories, which I think permaculture does well. It tells good stories about and envisions really well what our systems can look like, our agriculture, our garden systems. But I think what we're missing is good documentation. It doesn't have to be necessarily, you know, laboratory, really intensive scientific research. But we don't necessarily document our systems well. We don't have data to show what happens when we implement a certain practice. And so I'm excited about the mutual benefit of bringing sort of academia and permaculture into the same conversation.
It's one of the places that I'm very excited about where things are going. The interview that is going to be released before our conversation is one that I had with David Holmgren. And in our conversation, he said that he wasn't so concerned about the idea of taking permaculture mainstream as much as doing the practical work of showing working permaculture systems in our different environments that could then be replicated. And I think that the direction that we're going as over the last 100 years or so of our scientific research has become more and more reductionist. Now that we've got all these little pieces, the movement is towards a more holistic approach to let's bring all these things together, let's go interdisciplinary and have everybody talk so that we are working on a larger vision, that 30,000 foot picture as opposed to that 1-inch picture of these smaller and smaller pieces. But before we go too far down that road, let's go back to the work that you've been doing with agroforestry. So if you'd like to go ahead and give us a definition of agroforestry and the various aspects of that, and we can lead into the further conversation.
Agroforestry, the USDA does define it and is very specific. And my simple definition is really it's tree agriculture. Agro being agriculture and forestry being cultivating and supporting tree-based systems. And so with agroforestry, we look at the interface between crop production and forest management. And so we select the proper species and the proper combinations. We think about things, especially with crops, we think about light regime a lot. You know, how many trees can we pack in a system without shading out what we're trying to grow? Or, you know, in some cases, like with mushrooms, we actually want as much shade as possible. So we look at those relationships. It can be with between two, you know, crops. It could be as simple as something like a row of black walnuts in between rows of corn. It could be as complex as something like managing pasture underneath a tree canopy and grazing animals and everything in between. The USDA defines five agroforestry practices. The first is forest farming. Forest farming is the cultivation of non-timber forest products under the canopy of an existing forest. So mushrooms, ginseng, different medicinal plants would be good examples of forest farming. We have alley cropping, which is simply planting rows of trees in between the rows of other crops. So I mentioned black walnut and corn production, which is actually something that happens down in the southern states. So that's a nice one often for crop farmers because you can justify and show the economics of potentially adding a longer-term crop into an existing tillage-type system. The third practice is riparian buffers, and this is really taking the focus of tree crops to waterways, whether they're small streams or even large rivers, floodplains, thinking about how to design a floodplain ecology often or a river ecology. And hopefully that ecology can also be multifunctional, producing food or other human uses as well. The fourth practice is windbreaks. So, you know, specifically designing tree systems to break the wind and shelter different elements on the farm. And the fifth one is silvopasture. And silvopasture is, silvo is from silviculture, which is forest management. Pasture is obviously grazing. So we have really a three species or a three type system. We have the grazing animal, we have the grass, and we have the trees, and look for the right combination of those three things. Ken and I have sort of informally added a sixth agroforestry practice, which is forest gardening. We want to distinguish forest gardening from forest farming. And with Dave Jackie and Eric Tonesmeyer's book talking in depth about forest gardening, you know, a lot of people ask us now, what's the difference? And, you know, the difference is that, again, forest farming is something where we cultivate under an existing forest. So we might have a forest that's been growing for 20, 30, 40 years. Forest gardening is a practice where we are mimicking the forest. We're actually colonizing an open space and often growing it from scratch. And we're looking to mimic the structure and function of a forest. But we're often dealing with a higher light regime in the sense that often a forest garden strives to be mid-successional or strives to have a 30 or 40% canopy coverage. Forest farming situation might be more like an 80 or 100% canopy cover, where we're really trying to preserve typical forest type of wherever you're trying to cultivate the practice.
Could you define that term light regime?
You know, I always joke that academics like to make things sound really complicated. Light regime is really the idea of looking at how much light we're letting hit the forest floor or the field crop. And so with agroforestry, the big limiting factor is you're bringing trees into the system and you have to think about how that's going to affect everything else. So, you know, when I say 100% forest canopy cover, it might be good to think about something like a sugar maple forest, which has dense amount of trees. It's often, they're very thick and they tend to shade out most of the sun that's actually coming through. If you think about something where the trees are spaced further apart, or think about a tree like a black walnut, let's say, that has less thick of a leaf structure, and then we get into a light regime that just means more light is passing through. So the regime is really just the variable there in terms of light penetration.
Okay, thank you. With adding this sixth idea of forest gardening, would you discuss the difference in your work then between forest farming and forest gardening? Not just in the idea of with a forest farm that you're going in and planting in them. That kind of makes sense to me that I could go into the woodlands next to where I live and plant some understory crops or understory trees, some shrubs and herbs and things like that, versus designing my own forest garden. Like with where I live in Pennsylvania, in designing a forest garden, could I just go into my local forest and start picking trees to put in there as my overstory and then just plant under that and do a direct mimic? Or are you thinking of a more broadly designed difference between the two?
I think what's important, sort of simplify it, is to say that forest farming is farming in the woods versus forest gardening is farming or gardening like the woods. I don't particularly think it's important in the end to distinguish the two when we're actually out in practice. Just like if you start to get into, well, you know, at our farm we have ducks and we bring our ducks into the woods. And I don't really care if it's called forest farming or if that's a form of silvopasture because we're involving animals. You know, when we look at these six different distinctions, it provides a slightly different perspective or a slightly different focus for tree crop systems. But in the end, what we're interested in is perennial-based systems, and we're interested in the combinations and the relationship between the plants and how we can stack as many different plants in an ecosystem that is a forest in the end, or that will be a forest when we're long gone. And I think that's the most important goal for any of these practices. And so what I've found is when we visit farms or we visit someone's backyard, there's never that perfect example that says, well, this is farming versus this is gardening. I think the key thing is with forest farming, we often are looking at ways to, you know, maximize productivity and preserve existing woodlands, preserve trees that we want, you know, we value. So, you know, an example on our farm is that we moved onto the site and we have almost entirely open pasture. It's old, you know, hay and grazing land. But we have this 1 acre that's this amazing little grove of sugar maples. And so from the beginning, we said, you know, we really want to preserve this existing forest. These are healthy trees. We really value this forest because it's such a small part of our land, which is so open. And so we really said, well, what are our practices that can companion to that? And so, you know, mushroom cultivation does really well in that kind of situation. And maple sugaring, we sugar on a very small scale in that situation. And that's key because in forest farming, often you say, well, I can insert, you know, one or two different practices or a few different species and I'll stop there. With forest gardening, you're often starting with more of a blank slate and you're designing it from the ground up and you're saying, well, I want this fruit tree and I want these herbaceous plants and these shrubs, and it's going to be this real cornucopia of harvestable, edible crops. And so you have a lot more of a species palette to play with. You have a lot more options when you get into forest gardening because you're often starting with, you know, 100% light. And what you're going to do as a designer is fill in that space and start to play with different options. So I think there is some distinction to draw there, but it's really important only on a conceptual level. When we actually hit the ground running, hopefully understanding how trees grow, understanding the light concepts that we might be dealing with, those are really the important things as we move forward.
Though right now when you mention maple sugaring, my stomach says that the most important thing is to send you a jar and have you send me some maple syrup. There are maple festivals here in Pennsylvania, and as part of our farm show, it's a treat for my family to always go and get some maple cotton candy and maple sugar candy. So, but I kind of traveled on my stomach a lot of times. But when you look at these practices and are implementing, when it comes to the forest farming, would you consider removing certain trees, say removing a Norway maple that's growing in an area to replace it with a sugar maple because that would provide you with a different product in the end?
I think when we specifically look at forest farming, which we're often working with what existing woodlots we have, we have to think about and value the sort of work that's gone into creating that forest. And so it's easy to say, well, I don't like this maple and I want this maple, and so I'll just replace it. But, you know, if that maple's been growing for 40 years, that's an investment really in the land. And it's going to take another 40 or 50 years for the sugar maple you plant, you know, to mature. What we try to do with forest farming and with any of these practices is we lean on forestry professionals and we lean on the principles and practices of sound forestry. And rather than, you know, try to say, well, I want these species, so I'm going to put them in the forest, we say, what is the existing forest type? And often that forest type will tell us about what the land can support in terms of the type of ecosystem. And we try to work then to manage that ecosystem successionally in the direction it's already headed. And so what we more often do than replacing the type of species is we look at, you know, what diseases might be in the woods, what trees aren't doing as well, maybe structurally. And long term, we want to manage for diversity, you know. So again, back to the example on our farm, we have this 1 acre little patch and it's mostly sugar maple. We've removed all of the ones that have showed any sign of disease, we've taken out. And we've also, on the fringes of this forest, are patches of oak, red oak, and patches of hickory. And when we look at big picture, we know that with climate change and with warming temperatures, we're going to have a greater chance that sugar maples aren't going to have as good a chance at regeneration. Their seeds need a certain number of days below freezing in order to germinate, and that our forest types are actually going to be changing from maple-dominated forests to hickory and oak-dominated forests. And we have that data and that analysis from the USDA to sort of guide us and think about what that could look like in 100 years. So one of the things is we have to think about how to, you know, start to encourage those hickories and those oaks to seed into the maple woods and become a much more diverse woodlot. And what that means is, in the end, is we have to open up light. We have to bring light into the forest floor in order to get those nut seeds to germinate.
You've just answered so many questions that I've had in the back of my mind in conversations that I've had with a friend of mine who's a trained forester. We've had a lot of the conversations about how to do certain things, but I've never stopped to ask him why there are certain practices in that case, and you've just clarified a lot of that for me about not removing certain trees and other practices, so thank you for that. Also, the long-term successional, having that data to know what's going to be moving and how that changes our long-term plan so that as permaculture designers, we can design ourselves out of the system in that long term as well. If someone wanted to find that information, is that all available through the USDA?
As you probably know, there's never one good spot for all the answers. There is Climate Change Atlas for trees. If you search U.S. Forest Service is actually who's done that. It's Climate Change Atlas. It'll give you really interesting data about predictions for certain tree species and how that might change over the course of the next several decades and I think even further into the future. And so you can get some sense of that. Our book is trying to discuss eastern forest types, discuss what a typical maple forest ecology is, and discuss what a oak hickory forest type looks like and a few others in there, and really try to educate our readers about those forest types as a way to mimic and understand how we might functionally bring more crops into those systems. And so it's tricky. There's not a lot of good analysis out there about telling that story of how the ecosystems are very specific to different landforms, different soil types, different elevations, all those things, and how then we translate that into design. So that's something we're trying to tackle in our book. Another resource I would recommend is to learn some of the principles for forest management. And probably the best book I've found out there is called The Redesigned Forest, and that's a book by Chris Mazur. And it's just phenomenal in terms of the way he approaches discussing forests. And, you know, the challenge with tree crop systems and forestry is that we're often making decisions that we won't even see the impacts of in our lifetime. We're just looking at systems that are on a scale of generations. And I think that that's really the challenge in why agroforestry, especially in temperate climates, hasn't been as forthcoming, because it's hard for us to foresee and to vision that far into the future. So we can understand annuals a lot better, or even short-lived perennials, because we'll see the efforts of our labor in our lifetime. And I think we see agroforestry much more prevalent in tropical and warmer climates. And I think part of that is because things just grow so darn fast and you really get that gratification. And it's a long haul with agroforestry. We have some things like mushrooms that we can get in the first year of production, but you know, the trees are really going to take a while. So that's really a key piece to keep in mind and to vision for and really support. And that's something we want to do. We want to be leaving really healthy forests, you know, for our kids and for their kids and so forth.
Can you walk us through that timeline of short-term, mid-term, and long-term yields from these kinds of a system? You mentioned that mushrooms would be something that you could have within a year versus, you know, a sugar maple might take 40 or 50 years.
Maybe I'll give an example of a system that we're going to install on our farm. And it's a mix of silvopasture and riparian buffer. We have a bottomland on our land that has a seasonal creek that runs through it. And when we think about what type of ecosystem might thrive there, one of the trees we came across as our sort of long-term yield was black walnut and butternut and different members of the juggalanthus family. They tend to like wetter zones. They can handle some periodic flooding, those kind of things. We actually have a number of butternuts already growing down in that area of the land. And so when we start from that, black walnut's a tree I'm so fascinated with. It has so many uses and benefits, and it's just a gorgeous tree in itself. You can eat the nuts, obviously. It's a great wildlife food. The wood is really high value. You can actually tap black walnut. There's now research at Cornell looking at walnut syrup production. you can make a dye from the husks of the nuts. And so it becomes this really wonderful potential tree. You know, the reality is if you're looking for nut production or you're looking for timber production, you're talking on a multi-decade type scale. So we started to think about then, well, what could we stack underneath that walnut in order to stretch over multiple timescales? So another plant we're looking to design into the system would be the pawpaw. The pawpaw is jugalone tolerant, which is important if you're working with jugaland species because they exude a toxin from their roots that suppresses certain types of plants. Pawpaw's really happy in jugalone environments. We have pawpaws that have been growing for almost a decade in the nut grove at Cornell and doing quite well under black walnut. And it's this niche fruit. When people taste it, they're hooked, and so there's a demand actually around us for pawpaw. So good crop, and we're looking at starting to get fruiting in, you know, 3 to 5 years and max production in 10 years, right? So that's our maybe midterm potential for production. And then we have underneath that, we're looking at a grazing system, a silvopasture system with sheep being the choice for us. So managing a healthy, you know, bottomland grass ecosystem and then grazing the sheep through there and then having that the meat as a product to sell as well, which is, you know, on a 3 to 5 year time scale. That's simplified. We've thought about a lot of other things we could add, gooseberries and currants and black caps and black raspberry, you know, all those different types of ribes and rubus species all do really well in jugalone environments, in wet environments, and could be annual yields after a few years of establishment. Some people will plant rows of black walnut and cultivate garlic or other alliums as a crop in between. That could be a one-year yield. Of course, we could also be cultivating mushrooms underneath this forest canopy, and shiitake mushrooms are the one that we most often promote, and those yield after the first season, after the first growing season. So in that system, we can have yields all the way up to 40 or 50 years and all the way down into the single, you know, year time frame and everywhere in between. And I think that's really important as we actually try to promote these systems to farmers, is to say, you know, if you can't make money off of it in a decade, it's very unlikely they're going to consider that system. So we're looking for different strategies to promote that multidimensionality, both in time and in space.
You're looking to build, if you will, a 100-year farm, but one that you can have a farmer buy into in that first year so that you can begin by providing functional yields early on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that some of the forest farming crops that we're excited about, like ginseng, is a really high-value crop, but you're going to wait 7 or 8 years for that yield. But in the meantime, you can be managing mushroom logs and making a decent living off of it. Hopefully, one helps support your incentive to do the other, because you're already managing a forest system, then you might as well get your ginseng crop started while you're doing your mushrooms in the shorter term.
In New York, do you have to deal with issues of total daily load, runoff from farms?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a tremendous amount of runoff coming, and when we see our regular sort of rain events are certainly promoting that. And also these extreme events that we've seen, you know, the past 2 Octobers, we've had these offshoot of hurricanes coming through that have really dumped a lot of rain on the landscape. And, you know, I always drive around and I see the farm fields that have been tilled up and plowed and all of this. And the difference is striking between that and the forests you drive by and how well they're able to absorb and actually make use of that extra rain as a resource. I feel like it's a liability for a cropping system, and it's often a resource for a forest.
I've noticed similar issues around here as I drive by some of the farm fields. I'm not far from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and I'll drive through there, and it's just like even the streets in the small towns around the farm seem to run brown with mud after a heavy storm. And one of the issues here is that we're in the Susquehanna watershed, which feeds into the Chesapeake Bay. And one of the conversations around here is about building riparian buffers to help reduce that, because there are ongoing talks about fines being levied if these numbers don't change. I haven't heard about any actually having been handed down. So that turns into questions of, well, let's build riparian buffers along these streams and waterways on farm fields. But when you look at how much water runs through some of these places, that can be acres and acres taken out of production for a farmer if they're doing something like a 100-foot wide buffer as a minimum, as is recommended by some places such as the Stroud Water Research Center. And it sounds like combining these principles that you have presented about agroforestry and forest gardening, that we can develop functional systems for farmers, where they could then take that out of normal production and replace it with high-value crops, and again, get that buy-in that's necessary to make these changes. Do you think that something like that is possible, to provide those kinds of numbers to help farmers make that transition?
I think it's not only possible, I actually think that with a shift in our perspective, it's really the answer. It really provides the type of agriculture that will be long-term. And it's not a, well, I have to sacrifice this field in order to have this benefit. It's actually like, wow, I'm actually developing a system that over time is less labor and better yields. And so if we're looking at riparian buffers, what we have to look at is, again, the very specific ecology of, again, whether it's a river or a stream or pond or a wetland, and really learn about the types of plants that exist there, and then do what we call analog design, which is to look for potentially replacing some of those species with cultivars or with other potential higher value crop species that'll perform the same ecosystem services, but will also provide that incentive for human use. And so I mentioned our example there with, you know, black walnut. We could plant sort of the native black walnut. We could also look at things like Carpathian walnut, which is bred to crack out as a better nut. It's a larger fruit that comes off of the tree, that sort of thing. You could certainly design a riparian buffer for some periodic grazing. And if you're, you know, the trick with that is really getting farmers to think about rotational grazing, because none of these systems, and especially a silvopasture, especially a grazing system with tree crops, you won't have success if you leave your animals in there and allow them access whenever you want. And if you think about a riparian buffer, there are certainly times of the year when you really don't want that type of activity. But once that area dries out, we could certainly bring the animals through. And so as we get more sophisticated with our farm design, we can see a riparian buffer not as a sacrifice zone, but actually just a different type of ecosystem that we can bring our animals through or plant other tree crops in, that like a wetter soil or something like that. And so we really just have to match the type of species we're looking at with the ecosystem that we're dealing with.
And then in dealing with a farmer, we can look at something like a whole farm planning system in order to have that conversation, to look at both what the farmer's needs are as well as the ecological services that something like this would provide, and tie all that together into a bigger picture, both for the farmer and their long-term needs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that on our farm, we see now, what's interesting that it's sort of this emergent property of our design process on our farm. We have a 7-acre farm that we're designing right now. We just bought it last year. And I obviously was interested in forest farming from the beginning. I was growing mushrooms. You know, I've been growing mushrooms for 5 years, and was a natural thing. And then we started tapping the trees, which I've been doing for 8 years, and it was this natural thing. But we realized that we spent one winter and we really have a lot of wind on our site, so windbreaks have to come into the system. And then we have this little creek area, and so riparian buffers become this template to design from. And we're probably going to have some elements of silvopasture bringing animals into all those systems. And so in the end, I think it is a whole farm system where most farms could probably benefit from utilizing almost all of the agroforestry practices. We'll have forest gardens as well on our farm, and those are really what we see as in permaculture are zone one gardens. They're more intensive. There's a lot more species. We might have dozens or even hundreds of species in our forest gardens versus when we get out to the riparian buffer, we're only going to have 3 or 5 species because it's a larger piece of land, and we're looking for, you know, longer pulses in management and more specific yields at a higher rate. So I think all of these practices are really part of a whole farm, and most farms that I've been on have upland forests, have, you know, mid-slope areas, have lowland areas and riparian areas that have creeks or water features. And so we can utilize, you know, really match these different practices to these different areas on the farm and start to really paint a picture that's not, we're just going to plow everything or mow everything or do rows in every part of the farm. We're actually going to really accentuate the natural character of this landscape by utilizing different practices that really match the type of land that we have.
You remind me in your response to that, when it comes to permaculture, one of the big things that I like to encourage with folks is to develop a sense of place, to have an understanding of the area that they're in, because then you get used to the seasonal flows, the birds and animals that are going to come through when plants come about. But at the same time, when you talk about the farm and everything that you've seen, even as we establish a sense of place in our area, it's important to see these other systems. I would want to encourage folks then to tour farms in their area. If there's a local farming organization that does farm tours or like a farm to plate activity or something, so that they can get out on site and see these different pieces in practice and have a part of it of their mindset then when they go to design and have a broader understanding of not just their backyard or not just their neighborhood. So thank you for that. One thing that you've mentioned several times throughout is mushrooms. And it sounds as if they've captured your spirit, if not your heart, if you will, with the work that you've been doing with them. Could you guide us through some of the work that you're doing with mushrooms and how they've become an important part of your systems?
Well, it actually starts back in the sugar bush. I was conducting a timber stand improvement thinning of a sugar bush that I managed for a nature center I worked at. And from that experience, we had all these sort of leftover logs, and they were all about 4 to 8 inches in diameter, pretty small diameter logs, and they can always be burned in the wood pile kind of thing. But I was like, there's got to be a better use for this type of material. It seems too high value to just burn. And we had a farmer up the road who was growing shiitake, had been doing it before it was cool. I always joke, you know, he's been doing it for 10 years, and now it's really just catching on as a practice. And so we had him to the nature center and did a workshop on shiitake cultivation. And honestly, the first time I did it, I didn't really believe it. It's such a departure from normal cultivation. You know, you're taking this moldy, what looks like moldy sawdust, because it is. It's inoculated with the mycelium that is the mushroom body, and you're inserting it into this log, and then whoever's doing it with you tells you, well, put the log in the woods for a year and check back on it, and you're going to get these mushrooms. And so, you know, it seemed too good to be true, or it just seemed kind of an odd practice. And it was really the first time that the mushrooms popped out the next spring that I was really sold, because I've always liked to eat mushrooms. I enjoy them. It was only later that I learned about the really powerful medicinal and nutritional benefits of mushrooms. But when you see a mushroom coming out of a log and you observe it growing and you harvest it and you eat it fresh, it's really the same as if you grow a tomato in your backyard versus if you buy it from the store. There's just really no comparison to the enjoyment of that as a food crop. And what was really powerful for me was from the outset was I suddenly was producing really high value food. And I don't just mean monetarily, but actually as a food source. I was producing it off of something that I had previously seen as a waste product. It was something I had to do as part of a forest management plan for our sugar bush. And when I saw those two things connected, that the waste from, you know, again, one agroforestry practice could be the food of another, and that mushrooms have this incredible power to what we call upcycle. They take a low-grade material, something we cannot eat cellulose in wood and then get any energy off of that, but they can consume it and then produce a mushroom, which we can consume. It's sort of the same with grass. We can't consume grass as people and gain sustenance, but we can graze animals that can convert that through the rumen in their digestive tract, and then we can consume the animal product. It's this powerful suggestion of upcycling, and really the ecological niche of fungi is to do this work that none of us can do. No bacteria can break down those complex bonds that exist in wood. And so it really ties us into what it means to manage a forest when we start to engage the mushroom layer, if you will. If we don't just think of the forest as the trees, but the importance of mycelium and all the growth that they provide and all that decomposition, they're really the soil builders. They're really the first line of taking dead material and turning it into new life or into new soil. That really has been the inspiration for me, and shiitakes became this, it was a hobby, and then a few years ago I said, this looks like a really promising crop. And at that time, Cornell Cooperative Extension, again with Professor Ken Mudge, he had been doing a decade long of shiitake research. He had been looking at the different strategies and testing out different types of wood and different types of management to find best practices for shiitake management. And the Cornell and also the University of Vermont received a grant in 2010 where we were to educate farmers about shiitake cultivation and engage a specific amount of farmers in inoculating 100 logs and giving us data about their experience producing. And we have that data in. We educated several hundred farmers. We had about 30 that ended up doing the research with us. And it's really promising. We see a really good return on investment. It might cost you $5 in terms of labor and materials to inoculate a log. And as a farmer, over its lifetime, that log is going to give you $50 or $60 worth of mushrooms. Shiitake is really the poster child of the mushroom world in terms of the one that we can really cultivate successfully and easily. And the nice thing about shiitake is you can inoculate logs, you can soak them, and then they will produce a reliable crop from that soaking. What I mean, soaking them in a tank of water. Other mushrooms we've been experimenting with include oysters, lion's mane, hericium, and maitake, or hen of the woods, and also stropharia, a wine cap. And all of those ones are on a very experimental basis, and we're trying to sort of figure out reliable cultivation. But honestly, we think that these mushrooms are good companions to shiitake cultivation, which is by and large the most reliable method or sort of species to produce mushrooms on in a forest setting. And it's important to draw the distinction between log-grown, forest-grown mushrooms and the mushrooms that you get in the supermarket, because most, if not all of those, are grown indoors in climate-controlled environments. And they're often grown on compressed blocks of sawdust or grain, and they often have nutrients that are added to that medium. So we have a contrast from a pretty energy intensive, we're talking about, you know, temperature and humidity control indoors 24/7, 365 days of the year. We have that being most of our mushroom production is done in that kind of scenario. And then we have the log grown mushroom, which we inoculate, we put into a natural environment, and then the mushroom, you know, fruits on its own. We don't have any climate control. We don't have a need to create the recipe for the substrate. The logs provide the best substrate, and those are logs that we can get from, again, sustainable forest management. And the nutritional value and the food value, the taste from forest-grown mushrooms is significantly better than the ones that are grown indoors. And no one really knows why, but there is research specifically with shiitake that shows that the nutrient content in a log-grown shiitake is superior to one that's grown, you know, indoors.
I live not too far from the largest mushroom production area in the United States, in between Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia. And I've driven through there on many occasions, and you'll see the piles of straw and manure and every wood chips, everything they're putting together in order to get the material that they need. And then once all that's used up, you can then get the leftover mushroom soil for your garden if you want, just because they need to dispose of it. I haven't yet gotten to taste the difference between the two, but I look forward to it. I have some friends who are raising some of their own mushrooms now.
There's an interesting backstory to that. Most of the mushrooms we eat, 90% of Americans eat either button mushrooms or cremini, the little brown ones, or portobellos. And those are actually all the exact same species of mushroom. They're Agaricus bisporus. And they're just different stages. When the mushroom first comes out, it's a little button, and that's the white one. And as it opens up, as the cap opens up, it becomes slightly brown, and that's the cremini. And when it's fully open, it's actually the portobello. And the production in Pennsylvania came from the city of Philadelphia. When it was horse-powered, essentially, there was a manure problem. There was a waste problem, and that manure was brought out of the city, and mushrooms were grown on it, and that was sort of the solution to its problem. And that continues today. It's really hard for us to grow Agaricus bisporus, any of those mushrooms, in the woods. They grow best on a multi-stage compost, which is what those facilities are doing. And I eat mushrooms from those, and I'm certainly not trying to knock down the mushroom industry that exists, because it's relatively sustainable, especially when we compare it to some other food options. But I think it is a contrast to say that there's something in the log-grown mushrooms, and especially with something, again, like shiitake, where we can grow that into the woods and we can manage our eastern forests while we do that. There's a really big promise there, and so we want to promote that. But, you know, as far as my portobellos, I'm going to probably keep buying them from the store, because it's going to be really hard for me to grow them on the farm.
And there's nothing quite like a nice large portobello cap, a little olive oil, some onion and garlic. Yeah. But there's my stomach again. One other piece that you've mentioned in our conversation is the book that you're working on with Dr. Mudge. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Like I mentioned, he's been really on the forefront of a lot of agroforestry research in terms of taking it from, I think, a concept to an actual practice. And so his biggest focus has been mushroom production. And I really give him a lot of credit for spending the time to do the research so that we can now pretty assuredly tell farmers that if you do inoculate logs in this way, you're going to get a certain amount of production. And that's a significant stride. We don't have, other than maple syrup, we don't have a lot of that data and a lot of that really reliable information for farmers. And that's a really important part of our work. And so he approached me a year ago and said, you know, I really like to write this book about forest farming. I really want your help. And I'd like sort of to weave in the permaculture perspective as we write, because the two practices, as I mentioned, are really closely associated. So we decided to go for it and approach Chelsea Green Publishing, who was very enthusiastic to support us writing the book. They've been looking for a book on agroforestry and specifically forest farming for some time. And if you look back, a lot of the tree crop agriculture in books are often, again, around the 1920s. We had Tree Crops with J. Russell Smith, which is still a phenomenal resource, and we're not going to even attempt to, with his perspective on things, but really be a companion to resources like that. The book is called Farming the Woods, and the idea is to present a wide range of different options for woodland owners, whether they're looking for commercial production or they're just thinking about hobby type things. And every class I teach, whether it's a permaculture class or a mushroom class or some extension event, people always have say, I have this woodlot and I don't really know what to do with it. And the only option that's often presented is timber management. So what we're excited about is forest farming really offers a much larger dimension to work with. We can cultivate mushrooms. We can be cultivating wild medicinal plants like ginseng or golden seal. We can be cultivating different food crops that really prefer the forest understory, like wild leeks or ramps, or sometimes they're called, or currants or pawpaw. You know, we can be integrating animals into those forest systems, and all while preserving the existing forest. And that's what's really exciting, is we don't have to, you know, cut down the forest and clear it and till it up. We can actually preserve that wonderful forest environment and have sort of all these different wonderful crops coming out of it as well. We also talk about ornamental crops, which for some people are either a commercial venture or of interest. So we've been doing research with orchids in our forest farm as an option for people that might want to grow their plants in a more natural setting. Orchids are typically a forest crop. And so growing them under artificial light certainly has its advantages, maybe in terms of production, but it's quite a different experience to really be growing them in the forest.
What is your time horizon for when that book will be released?
Right now, our goal is to be out in the spring of 2014. We're on track to get there. So that's a good thing. So hopefully by next growing season, we should have something out there.
Did you also have a Kickstarter campaign that you were working on?
It's actually an Indiegogo campaign. So for the book, you know, we have a lot of research-based information. We have a lot of what we call recipes. So if you want to cultivate mushrooms or you want to grow ginseng, we're going to tell you exactly how to do it step by step. And we feel really good about, it's not a textbook. It's really a narrative about the potential for farming the woods. What we're excited about, though, is to tell that story and also to say, we're not just a bunch of weird guys that are really into this obscure, you know, method of farming or gardening. There's actually a lot of people out there doing this as well. And what we've been finding is that forest farming and forest farmers are these amazing ecosystem stewards and these amazing twists on what we might think of as a farmer. And they're literally hiding in the woods. We don't often hear from them, and they're not in the spotlight in the same way maybe as an organic vegetable farmer is now, you know. What we're trying to do is visit as many forest farms as we can and document those and share that information both in the book and online. And so we have currently have an Indiegogo campaign through the end of April, where we're trying to raise money to support us to travel and visit more forest farms. And the idea is really to provide concrete examples so people are aware that this practice is not only a good idea, but it's actually already happening, and that we can learn from those that have been doing it and are sort of ahead of the curve, if you will, about this practice. So it's been fun, and we're about a third of the way through the campaign, and we're really thankful for all the support. We've had a lot of really great support from friends and from people we don't even know that are willing to donate. And we try to offer different perks for people that can support. So if people contribute $50, you know, they're basically pre-ordering a copy of the book. When it comes out, we'll sign it and we'll mail it to you. And the little extra that you're paying is going to help us travel and make the book that much better. So we think it's a win-win, and the response has been really great so far.
And I was able to go to Indiegogo and just search for forest farms and find the book. And I'll make sure that a link to that is included in the show notes for anybody who wants to, well, as you say, pre-order a copy of the book through this campaign and to contribute and make this happen. I think that this type of documentation is really important for folks to be able to see what's actually going on out there for the things that many of us aren't going to be aware of, because, as you say, there are people who are just in the woods. And I'm reminded of the conversation with Rafter Sass Ferguson about him documenting farms that are self-identifying as permaculture farms, because you just don't hear about them that often. We need to know what's going on that broad scale in that regard, and also to know the on-the-ground techniques that make the difference between the research and actual production.
You know, I work with Rafter pretty closely, and so his work really inspired us to think about bringing that really that practical approach to things and to look at case studies. And really, Rafter and I have a lot of conversations about permaculture's integrity and sort of documentation and how we can be better about sharing the work we're all doing, because we have to get beyond just telling really good stories about this stuff. We really have to show examples. This is a 10-year-old project that has been doing X, Y, and Z, and here's the data to show how things have changed over time. You know, we really need to head there if we're going to see the larger agricultural and gardening community adopt these practices. The USDA did include funding in the Farm Bill, or the U.S. government recently, for agroforestry. They're interested in the concept. The University of Missouri has an agroforestry center, and they've done a really good job documenting and doing the economic analysis of agroforestry systems in the South. And we really hope that our book can be one way to have that start that conversation in the Northeast, and especially in temperate climates where we don't have as much adaptation or adoption, I should say, of these practices. And our goal is not just to, you know, a book is a really wonderful way to spread information, but it once it's published, it's sort of fixed. You know, we can update it maybe in a few years, but it's pretty solid. So our plan is to, with the farms we visit, and also we have on our website, which is farmingthewoods.com, we have a survey. So if there's existing forest farmers out there, we want them to go to our website and take that survey. We have a database now. We have over 50 people that have responded, and there's probably more out there. There's many more, I'm sure. And we also are starting a listserv so that we can have a network growing and having a place that they can ask questions and share resources. And so our goal is to have the conversation continue beyond the book, and that it can grow and that we can learn from each other, and that the network really continues to thrive, and that those people that are, you know, again, scattered out there in the woods can really connect with each other and learn from each other.
Well, I look forward to finding out more about the work that you're doing and where these farms are. If there happen to be any in Pennsylvania that you come to visit, let me know. I wouldn't mind really touring some of those myself, but also because then we could meet up, I could buy you guys a pint in appreciation for the work that you're doing. Before we draw things to a close, we've covered everything that I'd like to. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to the conversation?
Well, I think the last thing I want to mention is to bring this back home to permaculture. And since this is a permaculture podcast, you know, I think what's been really helpful for me is to stretch the dimension of agroforestry even further. And what permaculture has offered is the concept of polyculture design, and the idea of really looking for beneficial connections between multiple organisms. The way that's translated on our farm is we started with the shiitake production. We added in the maple syrup, so we have a nice two-story system. But Bill Mollison, one of his first quotes that always has stuck with me, and it's one I love to say, is the one he uses to exemplify the principle, the problem is the solution. And he says, you know, you don't have a slug problem, you have a duck deficiency. The idea being that we should look at problems as a deficiency in the ecosystem and something we may have missed in terms of a character that we can bring into the story to complete the play or something like that, you know. And so when I thought that in the back of my mind, I literally was like, well, that's exactly what happens. When you grow mushrooms, you have slugs. They come out of the woodwork. No pun intended, to consume your mushrooms, and it can be really frustrating. We actually did a survey and found that mushroom farmers spend 10-25% of their time actually just picking slugs off their mushrooms, and I'm sure any gardener knows that's a pretty unpleasant task. So what we've been doing at our place is doing some research about integrating ducks into mushroom production and looking at how to rotate them through the woods and through the mushroom yard as a way to deter slugs from ever even getting close to the logs. And I actually received a grant from Northeast SARE, which is Northeast Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education. It's been a wonderful process. I did it first last year, and now I'm going to be doing another trial this year. And it's a really interesting challenge, and I think it really hits home. This idea of polyculture and permaculture is a wonderful idea, but it's really actually challenging to work out the kinks when we're trying to put these things together. So far, the success has been quite good. But for instance, you know, I found that some ducks will peck at the mushrooms, which obviously negates any benefit. It's a learning process, and I have a feeling that, you know, it'll be 3 or 4 seasons before we have really solid data to describe this relationship, but I'm excited for the results, and I'm very optimistic about potential for this and for a lot of other combinations of species as we get further into agroforestry.
Well, as those seasons pass and you get more of this information, I'd love to have you back to discuss ducks and agroforestry and mushroom production in the future, because I have a duck deficiency in my yard, though I also have a legal roadblock to have them because of landscape. But that's one of those many roads we walk down to make these systems work. As the title of Joel Salatin's book says, and I feel often when I'm trying to implement these systems, everything that I want to do is illegal. But every day, you know, you make those phone calls and you make those changes so that they become legal and you can do more of this work. Well, thank you, Steve, for joining me. I've, as always, learned so much more than I knew going into this. There are more books to add to my library list to read. I think that I could read for a dozen lifetimes just on from the guests who I've had on in the last 6 months and everything they've offered. And thank you for being one of those voices in this time.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Steve Gabriel. If you'd like to learn more about him, go to the show notes at thepermaculturepodcast.com, where you'll find links to the Finger Lakes Permaculture Institute, as well as the Indiegogo campaign for his forthcoming book with Dr. Mudge, which will allow you to pre-order your own copy and help support their efforts to document as many of these forest farms as possible. If you know anyone who identifies as a forest farmer, or are one yourself, go to farmingthewoods.com and take the survey to help expand the knowledge of who the people doing this work are and where they are located. We have many, many ways to aid one another to expand permaculture. You do what you can, and I'll keep doing what I can. Along this journey, if you have any questions or comments, or I can help you in some way, never be afraid to reach out to me. show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or 717-827-6266. Coming up next will be Eric Tonesmeyer discussing his next book and the Kickstarter campaign he has going to support those efforts. After that is Andy Russell sharing an article from his website titled All Roads Lead to Permaculture. Lastly for this episode, if you're interested in the online PDC, the syllabus is available at thepermaculturepodcast.com/PDC. Check it out and let me know if you'd like to enroll. The class is limited to 15 people, with official registration opening June 1st, and the course starting on July 1st. And until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.